Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Sound okay at the back? Noma, you can hear me? All right. Sant, you can hear me? All right. Thank you for the questions, because I don't know what to say tonight. This is very helpful. I'm enjoying practicing with you. I'm enjoying the questions. It's actually a great honor to do this and a great privilege, because I learn a lot from, you know, just trying to express my own insights, and then your questions help me look at other aspects of practice, or and helps me to see if I'm expressing things in a way which is helpful. So I am quite grateful. So, Pratsotapan has awareness all the time? So that's one of those buzzwords like cheese. You have these certain kind of concepts that keep coming up in Theravada Buddhism, don't they? For monks, it's cheese and jhana. Sotapatti is one of those that comes up. So it's a big, big topic. But I think the best way to look at it is not to say that there is a person who is a sotapanna, but rather what are the preoccupations of awareness that prevent entry into Dharma? Put it differently, okay? Because the assumption of a person is already wrong view. Like one of the questions that people will ask, does Buddhism, do we have free will, right? And the question assumes personhood. So it's already a problematic question. So when you say, does the Sotapanna have awareness all the time, you already have a kind of problem in the formulation of the question. So I would reformulate it and say, there is knowing, there is awareness. And what is it about? What are the preoccupations of awareness that prevent entry into the stream of Dharma? And what is the stream of Dharma? Well, it's the way things are. So if we look at what Lompa Liam says in that reading, things are as they are. Right? People are just people. There are no good people, no bad people, no big people, no small people. So what classically, the way that's described is through the three, there's a list, you know, you've noticed that Theravada Buddhism has lists. There are 10 and there are 7 and there are 4 and there are 3 and there are 12 and there are, so we do lists in Theravada Buddhism. And the list here is Sangyojanas, and they're called the fetters in English. And so the first fetter is called Sakkaya Ditti, and that is, in English, is translated as personality view. So if we took that formulation, when awareness is preoccupied with personality view, that would prevent the knowing of the stream of Dharma or the stream of truth. Okay, so what would that mean? Preoccupation with personality view. Well, let's say I get diagnosed with liver cancer, okay, and the doctor says, well, you got 6 months to live, right? And then my mind goes into overdrive, thinking, I won't be able to make any more furniture. No. It starts to think, I have liver cancer. I'm going to die. I don't want pain. What am I going to do with my family? The mind goes into overdrive, thinking in a very personal way. And that's Sakkāya Ditthi, personality view. And why not? What else would you do, right? Whereas if then, in being given that diagnosis, I saw the mind start to create thoughts, personal storylines, based on fear, and there was the knowing, oh, fear feels this way, and fear produces these thoughts, then I would be knowing Dharma, wouldn't I? That would be the Dharma of fear and the thought consequent on the Dharma of fear. So then the awareness would not be preoccupied with Sakkāya Ditthi. It would know the way things are. Right? So that's not so far away. That's kind of doable. Many of you might, I don't know, some of you have seen a book titled at Lompo Samedo. Someone edited some of his talks called Don't Take Your Life Personally. I mean, you don't even need a book. The title's enough. Because in English, we talk a lot about taking things personally. This is don't take your life personally. And that's what Sakkāya Ditthi is about. It's one of the best titles of books I've ever seen. So the second one is Silabhata Paramasa. And that's usually translated as superstition, right? But Lompo, he gives it a very deeper, and I like Lompo Samedo's reflection on that. He gives it a deeper sense that it's the attachment to cultural identities. And by culture, I mean how you were raised in a family, or how you were raised in Thai culture, or Canadian culture, or what the culture says about what a man is, or what a woman is, or even what Buddhism says. So it's a kind of whole identity, which is kind of hidden. You don't see it, that is enculturated. So let's say, like in Thai culture, to point your feet at a Buddha Rupa is gross, right? To point your feet at an arahant is like death. and yet, it is simply a cultural form. So I've seen that. I've seen that where you'll have in a shrine room, you'll have a Thai person who has been in Canada a long time sitting in front of me, and there will be a Farang who has maybe an older man, and I'll be talking, and the older man will stick his feet out towards me. And the Thai person, even though they know, the Farang doesn't know, feel horrible, right? And that, you know, what is that? That's cultural conditioning. Because there's nothing immoral about sticking your feet out, right? But in a Thai conditioning, it is immoral. It's bop. And yet, it's not like in the Sila, is it? It's like, there's the ninth rule where you can't stick your feet out, right? No. So that's cultural conditioning. Right? And you can see how that can be so close to you that you don't realize you're doing that. I went to I was just in Japan before I came here, and I went to see the Kamakura Buddha south of Tokyo. You know, it's a very famous one, bronze, maybe 40 foot. I think it has the posture like that, famous. Well, I went there, and it's full of tourists. And they've sawed a hole in the back of the Buddha, put a door in the back so people can walk in and look out the eyes of the Buddha. And I said, oh, how can you do that? What? These stupid people. But they don't like a bunch of tourists, right? You know, like they go see Mickey Mouse, they go see the Kamakura Buddha. It's all the same. But for me, I say, oh, well, terrible. So what I did, I just went really mindfully, because everyone's just kind of playing around, having Coca-Colas and sitting on the Buddha's lap kind of thing. So I went really, really very slowly and mindfully, and I just bowed as gracefully as I could. And I felt it too, and it kind of stopped everyone. They said, what was that? Culture, right? So icons are cultural things. Now, obviously, like, let's say if I bow to an image and I think that image is going to give me power, that's what we call in English idolatry. I there's an idol out there and it gives me power. And that is very sila bhatta paramasa. But when we bow to this Buddha here, we're not bowing to an idol, we're using a symbol, right, to help us be inspired in our practice. So if you start to take religious imagery in Thailand as having power in itself, and that power is outside of you, and that you're praying to that, well, that's sila bhatta paramasa. And the Buddha never said that, right? How many Buddha images existed at the time of the Buddha? Zero. You know, that in Buddhism, it was very, the artists were very reluctant to invent Buddha rupas. And I think the first Buddha rupas came 500 years after the Buddha, in either Afghanistan or Madura, they're not sure. Because they realized it's very, the human propensity to make a deity the force of goodness. Whereas the Buddha says, no, the force of goodness is your own heart. So if you go to the Amaravati exhibit in the British Museum, they have some of the walls from the stupa and the surrounding fence that was at the great Amaravati stupa in South India, which that Amaravati culture, I think it lasted 1,000 years. It went through all kinds of transformations. But it's very interesting, they've displayed where early Buddhism, the carvings, you see no Buddha images. You see footprint, you see tree, you see a Dharma seat, and you see an umbrella. I think that's the four. And the seat or the place of the Buddha is always empty. The Buddha is never defined as a person. And then you see some of the sculptors, later on when Buddha images were invented, switched the stones around, took them out, and recarved them and put Buddhas in them. Put Buddha images in them. So that's a kind of coarse form of sila bhatta paramasa. So you find that people, you know, they think if you have a prop and you put it around your neck and Lumpur Man has blessed it, then bullets won't hurt you. Very dangerous. This is not a good idea. So you think that these things are imbued with power. And people pay a lot of money for that, don't they, right? I had a very interesting case in New Zealand. There was a Thai woman who had this, she kept being very proud of this prop around her neck. And she said, this is so much power, you know, it has so much goodness. And Kuba this and Kuba that blessed it. And I said, are you sure, you know, you really want to go there? She went swimming and lost it, Dok Narok. And she was so afraid. She was so afraid now because she didn't have her protection. She came and asked me for one. I said, I'm sorry, that's not my business. I don't do that. But it was interesting. You know, she thought she had power. She lost it. And then she thought she's finished. It was all her mind. Sila bhatta paramasa. So there are those kinds of, and those we would call superstitions, but there's also all of that kind of cultural identity that we have, which are quite often hard to see, but when you suffer in some kind of a way, which is like let's say Amaravati, we have usually 20 nationalities operating there, and you know, like a German might not understand an Englishman's jokes, or like, I guess in Thailand, I would say, correct me if I'm wrong, direct criticism would not be done. You know, like you'd never say to someone, you did that wrong. You'd probably say it more roundabout. That's what I've heard. So I might come from a culture which is very direct and tell you something, and then you'd think I'm a total beast. But I might think, well, that's normal, right? And we might have this great conflict about what? About cultural conditioning. This is not how you do things, right? So there's a lot of confusion that can arise around that. So if awareness, if we speak in this way, then if awareness is preoccupied with something like that, then that prevents the stream of Dharma to sing, well, it's just this way. It's just this way. If someone breaks sila, that's different. That's not cultural. If someone comes to the monastery and they start killing the squirrels, say, we'd say, get out. Not because it's cultural, because it's moral. You don't kill. You know, that's not cultural. You could say, well, it's only your culture. I'd say, yeah, but it's an agreement that we have, that it's about killing, and it's about the heart, not killing, and so on. So that's quite a deep one sometimes. It's hard to see. It's hard to notice. I think in like when I first went to Wapapong, I must have been so coarse, but not through no intention, but I just didn't understand the culture, you know, and there was a, you know, we have these gatons, the spittoons. There was a Western monk, right? And he was at the end of the line, and he didn't have a cup. So he took the gatong and drank water. Everyone's, whoa, that's interesting. He didn't know. Or I remember, we set up for the meals in the sala. And so I was helping to set up with a meal, and I was kicking the spittoons around with my feet. And Lompa Chas looked at me, said, "My sue." It was a very gentle way of saying, right? So culture, you know, these cultural things, if they are taken on, I mean, I don't want to live as an ape without culture. I like culture. I love Thai culture. I love its gracefulness and its beauty, but I don't have to be attached to it. So when I go to Kamakura and they're crawling all over the Buddha and I get angry, it's my mind, right? It's not them. And I didn't really get angry. I was just amazed, you know, like that. So if my mind is producing hatred or judgment of others or rejection of others or all of that, that's my mind. It's doing that. And it's stimulated by things which might seem kind of reasonable, but they're not necessarily reasonable. When Lompa Cha came to England, we were very curious to see how adaptable is he to Western culture, right? And very, you know, and to see, and of course he was totally adaptable, but there was one incident where there was one of the lay women who supported the we lived in London in a very kind of narrow space, and we had very few supporters. There's one woman who was an opera singer, and she was a Westerner, a great supporter, and she offered us dana. So there was Lompo Samedo, Lupu Cha, Lupu Samedo, myself, Anando, maybe five of us, and this would have been 79. And she was so nervous. She was so, so nervous. And she made this incredible meal. And Lompa Cha saw how nervous she was, and he praised her for the food. Now, you know, in Thailand, a monk never praises. You know, it's such a strong rule for us. We never say, wow, that hamburger was fantastic. You know, because then we'll only get hamburgers the rest of our life. But, you know, as a monk, you're very sensitive. If another monk is complimenting the cook, we say, what do you, don't do that. Yop. But he saw that Nora was very, very nervous, and he complimented on their friend. And we all noticed that, you know, and that was a kind of a capacity to sense. So this is a different culture, and this person's frightened, and they need encouragement. And it doesn't sound like a big thing, but it just shows that he wasn't attached to Thai culture. When one day we were coming back from Pindapad, I wasn't there, but I mean, I was at the Vihara, but I wasn't in that Pindapad. And there was, you probably heard this story, but Lumpu Cha first, so walking alms round on a busy street near in the north of London. And so you have Lumpu Cha, 5'2". You have Lompa Samedo, 6'2". Lompa Cha's got the biggest bowl in the world. Lompa Samedo has, and I think Lompa Kemetamo, 5'6". Right, so you have this, and they're walking slowly, and this, do you know what a skinhead is? It's one of, you know, it's a nasty Londoner guy, who has, you know, all the gear, and he was very aggressive, and so he started to approach us, and he kind of swore at Lompa Cha, and kind of faked that he's going to kick him, and Lompa Samedo said he was ready to hit him with his alms bowl if he did anything. But nothing happened, like, right. And then, so they walked to the Vihara, and then they got to the front door, and then before Lompa Cha went through, he turned to Ajahn Samedo. He says, oh, they teach very good here, Sondi. So he said, yeah, it was a good place to practice. It wasn't Thailand. So cultural attachments are actually quite hard to see. But if you're getting upset about something that isn't moral, right? And it's really not immoral what's happening. And why am I getting upset? Because I have a certain comfort in culture. And again, I like culture, I'm glad I'm not I am a primate, but I'm glad I'm not a chimpanzee, right? Or a gorilla. So I appreciate culture and the richness of culture, but attachment to culture, you know, that's something different. So that's the Sila Bhatta Paramasa. So as I'm saying, awareness is preoccupied with this cultural position, and it's not free. And the last one is doubt, and doubt, as I've been saying, is really the preoccupation with thought, where the mind always sees the solution to all of life's problems as analysis, thought, and so on and so forth. So it's the thinking mind. So in the text, it says that, you know, someone who has realized that stage has no doubt about the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. But what does that mean? Does that mean that you never have doubt? I don't think so, because doubt is just it's a dharma, isn't it? So I would say is that you don't understand, one would still be attached to the sense of self that believes in thought. The sense that all problems have to be resolved through thought. The sense of me being confident in thought, and then when there is doubt, not having confidence, needing to always find an answer. I would say it's that kind of thing. So when the knowing or consciousness or awareness is not preoccupied with those three things, we would say, then life is known as the flow of Dharma. Now, when it's known as flow and as the flow of Dharma, then it's a chance for the liberation of the asavas and kilesas. So the next stage once returner, we say, is the lessening hatred and lust. And now that's interesting. It's like when those three things are gone and there's the flow of Dharma, then lust is known as lust and hatred is known as hatred, then they begin to lessen. So they don't begin to lessen, it said, until they're seen to be a Dharma, a flow in Dharma. As long as they're taken personally, they just get recycled in the mind. So that's one way of looking at it. There's many ways to look at that, but it's a confusing teaching because people always think, I want to get sotapatti, like I want a hamburger kind of thing. And any teaching which says you have to get this, but you cannot reflect on it in any way, what is the use of that? I don't see how you can use that. You know, you have to get that. Oh, great, thank you. What is it, blue? But when you take it this way, and this is what Lompo Samedo has taught me, you can reflect on Sakaya Ditti as something that, you know, your mind gets caught up into. You can reflect on superstition and cultural attachments. You can do that, and you can reflect on this attachment to thought. You can do all of that, so it's doable. So rather than say, I have sotapatti or I don't have sotapatti, don't phrase it that way. Phrase it like, these are the three fetters, and abandon those three fetters. You can do that, and then you don't have to make a claim or not a claim. You can work with that no matter what you say. Now, obviously, we also have deep, what we call in English, epiphanies, which is a deep insight into like emptiness or deathlessness, and those are also very significant, very, very significant, and they come into it too. But I think this is the way it's defined in the text, so it's doable, it's workable. Okay, that's a long answer for the first question. No, there's another one I wanted to look at. Anyone busy? You have any appointments, or can I? Well, I'll do that one later. Would it be correct that the focus on walking meditation is the moment the foot hits the ground? Would it also be helpful to be conscious of the number of steps to keep the mind from wandering? Well, yeah. I mean, it wouldn't be wrong, but the problem with that for me is that you want to keep the mind from wandering, and then you get into a kind of forced march called walking meditation. That was good, wasn't it? Forced march. And then you're trying to control yourself and so that you don't think. And I would say that what it lacks is the understanding that thought, first of all, is natural. You know, it's just a function of brain matter in whatever ways, and that thought arises from intention. So if I have been thinking about clocks, you know, and I look at the instructions about, this is a very complicated clock, by the way, yeah? And I read the instructions, then when I sit in meditation, what's going to happen is clock thoughts will come, right? So you could say, I am thinking about clocks, or you could say, clock thoughts have arisen. And if you say, I am thinking about clocks, then if I am thinking about clocks, I say, well, don't think. All right? If you think you're thinking, then don't think. Right? Just say that to yourself. Okay, I'm not going to think. And how long does that last? It doesn't last for a minute. So what's actually happening is thought arises because of intentions and habit. That's, I think, more accurate. So what could you do about that? Well, you could start to change the habit. And how would you change the habit? Well, you could try to notice the end of thought. And just appreciate, oh, there's no thought. Now, when you do that, then you're not trying to get rid of thought, and you're noticing that thought is not a constant. You're not putting any aversion into it. Not that this person is doing this with aversion, I'm not saying that, but that is quite often the case. And what you're doing is you're putting a suggestion in the flow of consciousness that that's what you want to notice. You want to notice the end of thought, the space around thought, the gap between thought, no thought, okay? Rather than the suggestion to yourself is, I have to get rid of thought. Now, if you make that suggestion to yourself, unfortunately, you'll think more. It's perverse, isn't it? It's a bad joke. Okay, I won't think. Do that. And just sit there and think, I refuse to think. It'll last a while, and then the bell rings. And you'll be lost in thoughts. It's brilliant. So now you're not doing that. What you're doing is you're practicing awareness with thinking. That seems very, very hard. But if you just trust it, just say that, oh, like the suggestion I made earlier, say to your, you know, say a thought and notice the end of the thought. And then really make that the seed of your practice. Then when you're doing walking meditation, when the mind starts thinking, rather than trying to control yourself not to think, stop. And then notice no thought. But you have to do it deliberately. You can't just kind of, yeah, I notice, yeah, there's no thought, and then I keep thinking. You have to kind of make a deliberate intention and statement. So now the intentions you're putting into mind is not about thinking, the habit of thinking. It's about, oh, noticing something, oh, no thought. And if you do that, then what wins is silence. And what wins is awareness of thought arising. But we don't trust that because we're so impatient. But you have to kind of give it a go. Now, I'm not saying that this won't work. But what will probably happen is as soon as you take the control mechanisms off, your mind will just go brrrr. It'll just think. Because what you don't, you just control it. You know, you really controlled it. But now you're not so much, at least this is the way I've been taught, and this is the way I've learned it. So sometimes, yeah, you can do that, but look at it. What result does that give you? When you walk away from the meditation or the retreat, do you have a mind which can abide in no thought? You know, because that's what you want to do, right? You want to leave this retreat with the equipment to be free from obsessive thought. How might that work, right? Does this do it? Well, how would this work? Well, when you're in Bangkok and you're going from A to B, then this is what you'd have to do, right? And you'd run into a lamppost. You couldn't do this. Could you, you know, I mean, I tried this in London, right? I tried to walk around London like this, and it was horrible. And you can't do it because life is complicated. But you can notice the thinking mind in a complex situation, and you can let go of it. It's doable, right? So this might be a technique and give you certain results on a retreat. But Lompa Cha, and I come from that, you know, he taught us, he said, now just learn how to meditate normally. Just make it a normal situation so that all the time you can meditate. And he used to joke. He said, yeah, so do slow walking, but what are you going to do when you have diarrhea? And Lompa Cha. He always had a good twist. So I'm not dismissing this, and it has its place, right? But what is its limits? And then what is the limits of what I'm talking about too, right? You know, so if you've done that technique, where is it helpful? And what I'm saying, is it helpful or is this a joke? I don't know. But, you know, test it out. But I was certainly encouraged to do that. And really, I can walk around a city and notice my mind getting distracted and collect it, right? But I can still look at architecture, right? And when I get scattered, I can collect my mind. Or if my mind is worrying about something, I can notice it and just collect my mind on walking. I don't have to be super focused. If I go on Pindapad, right, I can notice the street, I can notice people and be collected, composed. I can notice thought. I can let go of thought, right? It's not. Yeah? But if I'm just trying to get rid of thought, yeah, no, it won't work. So I would look at that myself. One more? Two more? Three more? This is in the done pile. Ooh, it's long. This is an essay. Someone's just written a book. Anyway, throughout my meditation experiences, I observe piti sukha, happiness that arises from time to time. So when piti sukha arises, it will come to my consciousness. I observed and I'm aware of the body sensation that comes with it. The mind recognizes it, it becomes part of sanya, right? My next question is, that wasn't the question, wasn't it the question? Right, okay. My next question is, I have been using piti sukha as a part of the object of meditation, combining with the breath, also aware of the space around that, all taking place in any present moment. Is this practice correct? Very good. Very nice. I wish I could do that. Doable. Yeah, you're doing it, right? So very good, very good. As I found it to be very delighting and less stressful, is it wrong? No. Why, you know, enjoy. Why would it be wrong? Please explain whether and how we can meditate on piti sukha. Well, if you can make that conscious, then it's something you can sustain, isn't it? Because it's beauty. I try to bring beauty into practice through imagining people, right? So I imagine Lompo Samedo. Sometimes I'll even imagine my mom, you know, although she's long gone, or people have been generous, or I'll use beauty a lot in nature. You know, I'll just look at something and be drawn to it and see that. So it's not such a powerful emotional thing, but it's very uplifting. And I think we dismiss beauty sometimes, but I would say it's in the realm of mudita bhavana. So what is mudita? Mudita is appreciation and joy at beauty, isn't it? And so usually it's couched in terms of you appreciate the success and beauty of someone else. And that's very obvious I love it when a child brings something to mom that the child has just made, right? And, you know, it's some finger painting or something, and mom says, oh, you're Picasso. And it's beautiful to see both the mom's joy and the child's joy. And that's a form of joy that we can bring quite easily to mind. So I'd say, you know, whatever this person is doing, sattu, it's very healthy, very wholesome, very good karma. And for us to reflect on that we can bring that to mind. And that, I think we started the retreat with those ideas of mudita bhavana. It's a very lovely, lovely thing to do. Yeah, I've contemplated beauty a lot. Why do we, you know, we're really drawn to beauty. I'm obviously drawn to like Japanese woodwork, you know, the care. So I think I began the retreat, didn't I? I was talking about how do you bring care into the attitude? Yeah, if I remember. Well, how many days ago was that? But, you know, if we recollect what I was saying, it's like, like Lompa Cha saying to me when I kicked the spittoon, he says, "My sway," right? So how do I bring that like beauty into the attitude that I apply to mindfulness of breath? Huh? And what might that mean in my? So like when people offer me dana and flowers, you know, you could say, "Everyone's so graceful," and so beautiful in their offering. And that's an aspect of mind, isn't it? Right? So how might one do that in attending to negative states of mind like fear or pain? How would that have a place? Would that kind of caring attitude have a place to looking at fear? And I think it would, as opposed to, oh, there's the fear, I have to get rid of it. Or like maybe even the walking meditation, you know? Like I used to joke, it's like Viradhammo against the walking path now. Can I make it 20 paces and not think? This is so, that was like a battle. Well, whereas like just the gracefulness of walking and body, like what the Thai people taught me is the way the Thai folk move, you know, the way you move amongst each other, it's just so beautiful and so graceful and so gentle. And then we Furungs come in, boom, 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 boom. And that's one thing that like I think all of us early days at Wat Pho Phong, where we I think we watched pretty good and we saw, well, look how they walk and they don't bang the floor. And Ajahn Chah taught that a lot, you know, the way of beauty and mindfulness rather than force. The other day you said that the Dalai Lama is your teacher as well. So could you please explain about the awareness and the meditation in Tibetan Buddhism? What, like in 5 minutes? Are you kidding me? I hate to be facetious, but this is an absurd question. Tibetan Buddhism is huge. You know, it's not like a technique. So I suggest going to the library or going to YouTube and looking up Tibetan Buddhism, and you'll probably find a few websites. They have some very, very good practices of the heart. They have practices like before the teacher gives you a meditation instruction, you do 10,000 prostrations. They have very, very good visualization techniques. This is a great question. They have things like that we don't have. They have the stages of post-death experience, the Bardo stages. They're the only Buddhist school that actually talks about visualizing the states of meditation after death. We have nothing like that. So it's really, you see, Tibetan Buddhism is probably 1,000 years old, and Theravada is 2,600 years old. So there was 1,600 years of evolution, change in Buddhism, in all aspects of Buddhism, from its philosophy to its iconography, that then affected Tibetan Buddhism. And Tibetan Buddhism was influenced by Bengali Tantrism. So Tantra, if you've heard of Tantra, Tantra actually came from Hindu culture and from Bengal. And the Indian monk with us, Amara Siri, in Tisarana, he did a lot of the tantric practices as a Brahmin, so he could identify them totally in the Tibetan practices. So Buddhism had become Mahayana, which was a change from Theravada, and then it picked up all kinds of other schools, Pure Land and China and so on. And then the Muslim invasions, right, pretty much wiped out Buddhism by the 12th century, I think, in India. And there was refugees of Buddhists going up into the Tibetan plateau. And so this diaspora of Buddhists had learned Tantra, and the way Buddhism evolved was in competition with Hinduism very often. And if the royalty supported the best philosophers or debaters, I suppose, or whoever they chose, and there was always this competition for royal favor. So Buddhism and Hinduism have this great interplay, and then the different Mahayana schools too. So in any case, Buddhism then took on the flavor of Tantra, and then that went up into the Tibetan Plateau. And then into Tibetan Plateau, they had animistic religion, a Bon, it's called Bon religion. So that would be like the village magic that you find in Ubon, in black magic and white magic, and you find that a lot in Burma. So then all of that tantric Buddhism got mixed in with Bon as well. So you've got a real different kind of Buddhism now. And so like the say like in Tibetan Buddhism, they'll say that enlightened beings can reincarnate and become the Dalai Lama. And we don't have that, right? So that is totally different too. So even the idea of an enlightened being getting reborn is wrong view, Michaditti in Theravada Buddhism. But what happened also in the use of language is that the word arahant got downgraded. And arahant became a lesser achievement. And I guess it still had a bit of taste of selfishness in it. And the bodhisattva got an upgrade. Whereas for us, the bodhisattva was simply the life of the previous Buddha, and then there's the enlightenment. Whereas then Mahayana took that on and changed the whole idea of bodhisattva and arahant. So an arahant became a pejorative word or a negative word. It's like hinayana, selfish, want to be arahant, right? And then, so then, when a Mahayana, when Tibetans see a Theravada monk, they say, hinayana. And because they've been conditioned to think that Theravada is still stuck in some kind of selfishness called arahant. So when Lompa Cha was in England, he visited a large Tibetan monastery in Cambria, and we knew the lay leader of that. It's a huge center, and the lay CEO was very good friends with us, and he invited Ajahn Chah. And we had heard that they all thought we were lesser beings. And they were the kind of upgrade Mahayana. And so Lompa Cha went up there. And in the Mahayana, you have the story about Mahakasapa. And Mahakasapa puts up a flower. And everyone understands, the real Dhamma. So Lompa Cha, he had kind of heard that story. So he went there and took a flower and did this. And they said, It totally charmed them, and they all loved him. So they say, "Oh, he's a bodhisattva." So the history of Buddhism is very, very interesting. But if you want to read about their meditations, then please do so. I'll cover some of these tomorrow. Okay, we'll finish there. Ha ha ha.